Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time listening to the Guelph Politicast, welcome. Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or are just making life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or subscribe to it on iTunes. Today, I talked to Ward 2 City Councilor and Guelph Public Library Board Member James Gordon about Freedom to Read Week. But first, I have a public service announcement. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I launched the Patreon campaign for Guelph Politico. Through Patreon, you can contribute on a per-monthly basis of any amount you feel comfortable using PayPal or your credit card, and all that money goes to maintaining a locally sourced independent media outlet in Guelph called Guelph Politico. Through your generous donations, you will be paying to keep the Politicast going, as well as regular coverage of City Council and politics in and around and concerning the Royal City. For more details, click on the giant orange P on the right-hand side of the Guelph Politico page, or go to patreon.com/GuelphPolitico. Now, on with the show. In case you are unaware, this is Freedom to Read Week. Freedom to Read Week is an annual event that encourages Canadians to think about and reaffirm their commitment to intellectual freedom, which is guaranteed to them under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and is organized by Freedom of Expression Committee of the Book and Periodical Council. Freedom to Read Week usually takes place the last week of February, and this year it's between February 21st and 27th, so right now, if you're listening to us on Friday or Saturday. Beyond just books, though, Freedom to Read also aims to raise awareness on issues of censorship across all areas of public discourse and free expression, including the muzzling and silencing of journalists at home and abroad. Its challenged works list includes 100 books, magazines, graphic novels, and other written works, all of which can be seen on the Freedom to Read website. And that brings us to today's Politicast. I reached out to the Guelph Public Library to see if anyone would like to speak on the subject of Freedom to Read Week on the podcast, and James Gordon volunteered. Gordon not only sits on the board that oversees Guelph's public library system, but he's been a strong advocate for maintaining the city's current library resources, including the development of a new building of the main branch downtown. What follows is a conversation that we wanted to keep nonpartisan, if not apolitical. It would be really hard to make a conversation like this nonpolitical after all. We're talking about freedom of speech and censorship, but I think anyone of any political stripe will be able to enjoy what follows, but that's just my opinion. So I caught up with Councillor James Gordon at the main branch of the public library in downtown Guelph. So James Gordon, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Since it's Freedom to Read Week and you're on the library board, perhaps you'd like to begin by just summarizing what Freedom to Read Week means to you.
Well, the strange thing is it wasn't on my radar until I, you know, saw the press release, the same one you probably did, about that this is happening, and I look back over its history, and it's a great initiative and a great way to focus sort of a larger issue. Like freedom to read, you know, we associate with freedom of speech, mm-hmm. and yet it's also something a little different. So by shining that light on our history in this country and in North America too, about where has those freedoms been compromised, mm-hmm. and where are they at risk? And I was surprised, maybe as you were when you looked in it, just how much of that stuff is out there, mm-hmm. Those threats to our freedom to read. Mm-hmm. And I was as shocked as you probably too to see some of the books that have historically been, like they're books that are just part of our Canadian classics that you wonder, well, why would anyone have an objection to that? But it's looking at the why, mm-hmm. that's the scary part. Okay, there's still things out there that we need to address, and this helps to address it.
Yeah, you know, looking at the list, and we have a list right here. I mean, Harry Potter,
yeah.
I understand on a basic level, because right. magic is the doorway to the devil.
Right.
But something like In the Heat of the Night is on here.
Yeah.
The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is on here. Speaking of Canadian, Lives of Girls and Women, Alice
yeah.
Monroe.
Yeah. So it looks like any time, just by that list you just shared, if something new comes along that any interest group feels like is threatening their values, their first response is, well, no one should be able to read that, which contravenes our Charter of Rights, and yet it's surprising that sometimes they get away with it.
It's interesting, thinking about this week in particular, because of course what happened on the weekend, Robert Picton of all people has a book that comes out, and that quickly marshaled a lot of cries to silence that. I mean, and Robert Picton's an objectionable figure, no question, disgusting, as someone in the United States might put it, but it's still censorship.
Well, and that's a really interesting example, Adam, because I, as someone who is an advocate for free speech and human rights, to find myself defending his right to publish and disseminate that book, it almost feels that I'm at odds, because his own values are seem to be very counter to that same thing. But, and yet, we can't, if we're advocating for this freedom to read, we can't pick and choose ourselves.
Yeah. No, you're right. And that's, I think that is the big struggle, too. And of course, there was also Paul Bernardo, who released the book. I mean, and that had nothing to do with his crimes.
No.
Because Ontario has a law, you can't profit from your crime. And apparently, that law doesn't exist in BC. But, I mean, it was the same thing. My argument was, and we talked about this on the Open Sources show, was, you know, he's a completely objectionable figure. You would never want to read anything he's written in a million years, but should we marshal all our forces to, like, threaten to shut down Amazon if it's taken away?
Yeah, that's right. And if you are, if you do take part in some sort of a movement, okay, let's get his, let's not let his book see the light of day, you're playing the same game as the interest groups that would see Alice Munro's works too. So it's, it's slippery territory.
For sure. And of course, Freedom to Read Week doesn't just mean books.
No.
There's broader discussions about censorship in terms of the media, in terms of, Mohamed Fahmy was given the Freedom to Read Award. I think Penn gives that out, or the organization that puts Freedom to Read together puts that out. But I mean, he's a great example of someone who was jailed for just reporting and writing.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, we were just, before he turned the microphone on, we were talking about how this affects us locally. Should it be part of the mandate, and I would argue that it would, of this Freedom to Read, that we also need to foster accessibility to all kinds of information in the community. And, you know, since we've just lost our daily newspaper here, people are talking about a lot more, is, have certain voices been lost with that, or in our local community access to daily information or regular information? And is the excuse of this Freedom to Read Week also a time to look at, well, how can we not only encourage the freedom to say anything, but should we be able to encourage the organs that would enable us to see anything? Like, if we're, and I see it a lot because I travel a lot in the States, where if you only have access to a certain number amount of information or a certain style, and we can point to Fox News, for instance, in the States, it's become so pervasive that the other kinds of media that are out there that would be a counterbalance can't survive. With it. So it's a slant, and is that slant just as dangerous as banning books? And you could probably make that comparison.
And it's not just to talk about the Guelph case too. It's not just about freedom to read. Right. There's maybe an issue also of freedom to access, because there have been online entities that have come on.
That's right.
But you know, some old people don't use computers. They depended on the daily paper and it coming to them and having that kind of access to news.
Sure. And this is related, I guess, but you and I, just as we came down to our little talking spot here, passed by a shelf that the library's put out of some of these threatened books.
Mm-hmm.
And the librarian said, hey, we can't keep these on the shelves. People want to read them.
Yeah.
And so that's a sign of success for this week's event. By, if it would make someone want to go, oh, I wonder what was the big deal with that?
Yeah.
I want to read it. It also probably is going to open their eyes up to reading other stuff too. And that accessibility that you talked about, the access that we have, is it there? And I'm so grateful that our public library system is acting as a conduit for that accessibility and that freedom.
It's funny you saying that, to take the way this event kind of takes the culture, the salaciousness of it. Oh. You're something that people want banned.
Yeah.
And it's a book, and, yeah. I mean, and some of it's, you know, if you gave to a kid,
yeah,
The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, they're like, oh, it's all that takes place. And, but he's like, well, some people want it banned. Oh, they want it banned.
Yeah. There's something in there that must be pretty cool to read about.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another cynical side to it. Sometimes a book banning is good for business, too.
That's right.
Right?
To revisit censorship, you know, it's if you think about Charlie Hebdo, it seems part of the argument now with censorship is the violent reaction that some people have to a cartoon, let's say, and that concern. You know, and there's, of course, there's been these conversations here too, like how much do you print, do you run the offending cartoon, because then, you know, you make the case, the objectionable case, like, is this that offensive, and you put it in context.
Right. Huh. I think that's a good point about the Charlie Hebdo. What they were doing isn't new.
Right.
It's hundreds of years old satire, and yet maybe the violent reaction is that we're not seeing, it's not as everyday commonplace as it once was. Right? So Punch magazine was widely read in Great Britain for a couple hundred years, wasn't it?
And
so that was part of their everyday culture. So it was understood that you had that freedom even early on, and that those different voices had a place in our society. But when it gets isolated, I think when a publication like Charlie Hebdo looks like they're standing all alone, then they're leaving themselves open to that radical and sometimes violent response. And I don't know, did we do our job as a society to come to support what they're trying to do? I don't know.
It's a good question, because some people, I can't remember what award they got, but they were given some kind of, I think it was by Penn.
Okay.
For freedom of expression.
Right.
And some people said, well, no, because they were being provocative. They, not that they invited gunmen into their offices to shoot several staff members, but they were purposefully being provocative. It wasn't just them exercising freedom of speech.
Yeah, but maybe provocation, that's another issue in itself.
Like,
I think the press, to some degree, has lost that angle. Like, we're supposed to provoke, we're supposed to nudge, we're supposed to get you thinking about stuff. And if it's all just too namby-pamby in the middle, we lose interest in reading it.
Right.
So the newspapers disappear.
No, but even on something perhaps less provocative, or, you know, less prone to violence, I don't know if you've seen The Big Short, the movie about...
No,
the,
I keep hearing about it.
I mean, it is Oscar week, so I'll bring it up. But, you know, there's a scene in that where a couple of the guys who've been investing in the, in, you know, trying in the market crash and buying these stocks, and they go to the press and they say, hey, this is what's going on. It's like, it's happening. And it's I think it's a Wall Street Journal reporter who says, well, I can't go to these huge financial firms who give me tips and give me information, give me interviews, because I start accusing them of tanking the economy, I lose a job.
So everyone's playing it so safe, and maybe because, going back to Charlie Hebdo, there's an extra reason to play it safe, he could be killed. And that's a fairly good incentive to stay in
the understand that not wanting to be killed. But, you know, and I also understand that not wanting to lose your job. But I mean, that there is a, more of a struggle now, I think, between your own personal safety, be it financial stability or not wanting to get shot. And, you know, telling truth to power.
And how it relates is funny, just this knowing that this discussion was going to happen has got me thinking of these bigger pictures. I don't know if we've talked about this before, but in my own life as a politician or a, and as an artist, I get labeled an activist, and yet somehow along the line, that became a bad word. Like, that's a very positive word to me. It means you're not being passive, you know? You're and yet, the reason is it has a negative connotation is the same reason that some books end up on this list, that you're pushing in it. By being active, you're pushing an envelope. You're not playing it safe. And somehow we've shifted culturally to think that that's a bad thing. And it used to be something to be proud of. Or that you'd strive for.
And it depends on your point of view, too. Because to the ears of many, conservative is an offensive word. It's bad to be conservative. When what it really means is it's a more considered approach. You are conservative. You are conserving. But and the flip side, liberal too.
I'm a one of my heroes because I'm in the music business. Pete Seeger, who was a radical activist all his life, but he said, "Don't call me that. I am a conservative." He said, "Because I want to conserve and preserve." A way of life that is really important to me.
That's right. And, you know, there was that commercial. There's a commercial on now about healthcare and preserving healthcare. And the woman is, I don't assume she's an actual person. She's an actress. But she says, like, I'm not an activist. And it's just like, well, no, you are in the process of being an advocate right now, saying we don't want further cuts to healthcare.
That's right.
It's it's so weird that we don't even want to accept the definition of words as they're supposed to be defined.
And to circle this discussion around, if there's such a sensitivity of being active, of being provocative, that will lead to more book bannings, probably, won't it? Or or the more threats of that.
Right, because once someone sees you can threaten to go in and shoot a place up, then,
That's right. And so, geez, I'm not going to write that. I was thinking of writing this provocative book. I'm not going to do it now. I could be killed. Or it wouldn't find an audience, I think, too. That would be because if the Fox News mentality prevails, people think, oh, they're... You also, artists and activists also want to pay bills too, so if they
well, there is that argument about, you know, environmental scientists and their interest to promote climate change because that's what their research is.
But you want to know that you're going to find an audience for what you're doing,
right?
And if that audience is shrinking because of those fears, I can see why it would there'd be a domino effect too, right?
Part of that too is politically incorrectness, political correctness. Because if you look at a lot of these books, like Huck Finn is on the list because they use archaic language, like the N-word. What do you think that's playing a part?
I guess so. I mean, I run into it in the music business where I'll have some of my work is based on heritage and regional issues. So I'll I'll write about... I've done some work about stuff in the Arctic where I wouldn't say... if I'm writing from a historical concept, I wouldn't talk about the Inuit.
Right.
Because that's a modern term.
Yeah.
But if I say they're Eskimos, I'm saying that because that's the language that would have been used in the time period that I was writing.
Right.
So it's very tricky stuff. So should I not? So it's become a derogatory term, and I understand why. But are you honoring the spirit of what you're trying to write about in those times? That what the Arenda is a good example. Joseph Boyden's,
right,
where he portrayed First Nations people in Canada in a way that they thought it was some thought he was reinforcing the stereotype as them being savages, and yet he was, I take it, trying to paint the way it's come down over the generations and what life was actually like. So we can't write about the way we'd like it to be. To be more honest, this is the way it is. And some of this, the tough stuff now that we're writing about around, I would say, going back to your talk about political correctness, maybe there's a difference between correctness and accuracy.
that's an interesting way to put it.
Yeah.
Because it does seem like the immediate reaction, and again to visit that topic, is to if something doesn't meet a specific worldview, especially if it's a modern worldview.
Yeah.
The immediate reaction is just push it away, and we're seeing blowback against that. I mean, if there's sort of a lesson about Donald Trump in the States is, like, people will say, yeah, he says repugnant things, but he says it like he means it.
Yes, and that's right. So that's where they get the buy-in.
Right.
And things change so quickly, it's hard to keep up.
That's true, too.
I went to see a lovely production at the Guelph Little Theater on the weekend. Goodnight,
Desdemona.
Yeah. And it's a well-known Canadian writer, Anne Marie MacDonald, and it's probably a generation old now, that play. Like,
yeah.
So I was very surprised because she's been an advocate for different kinds of rights and LGBT rights, and there was jokes in it about being gay, things like that. That I listened to that and they fell flat, and I thought these must have been funny jokes 20 years ago, and now people are so much more aware that it hasn't stood the test of time.
Right.
But because with the internet age, things are so rapidly accelerated, something that you might have written a year ago and published today, how do you know if you're fitting what the current norm or the level of acceptability is?
For sure. Yeah, and I think that's, I mean, it's going to be a struggle for every writer, I think, especially since there's sometimes a lengthy process from having an idea to actually finishing the idea.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you might start an idea, and then by the time you're finished, it's like, well...
Oh, sure.
It's moot now because this has changed or that has changed.
Yeah.
Let's talk about you in particular and some of your favorite books. And we looked at the list and...
Yeah.
What have your experiences been like sort of in trying to engage challenging literature?
I'm actually right now reading, and I can't believe this is the first time I've read this book, but I'm reading John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. And it was a banned book.
So was Of Mice and Men.
Was it?
Yeah.
And I'm so fascinated now culturally, as I can see on every page, okay, here's the threat, because it's basically a radical socialist work,
right,
couched in as a literary work. It's a fantastic literary work, but now that I'm reading it with this in mind about, okay, why was it banned and what was the culture that it was written in, he was being so radical then about things that we'd take for granted now, But the reason it was banned was very similar to what we're seeing now. It was a threat to the current political norm mm-hmm. from the time. Even though it was written in the time of FDR,
right.
He was still pointing a light on corporate greed, and there's a lot of... I'd really recommend it to any listener to see the correlation between what's happening right now in terms of the... Like, it could have been written about the 99% and the 1%.
Yeah.
It's very similar to that, and yet they didn't have those terms.
Right.
So someone looking through it with that lens now, I'm just excited about every page as I'm nearing the end of the book. It's a very ambitious work, too. Like, okay, so he... One of the reasons that I'm drawn to it is because of those envelopes he was pushing, mm-hmm. and yet he did it as an artist. Personally, I can say, well, he's doing what I would love to do. As you know, I think you interviewed me, but I spent the last year out doing this Stephen Harper the Musical mm-hmm. project, where it was banned.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's the right word for it, but it would be... I would be booked into a theater, and the board of directors of the theater would say,
really?
This is too big of a risk, because I was talking with about the current governing prime minister,
right.
and they'd be worried about their funding.
Yeah.
The government funding if they promoted it.
Right. Of course, there was a conservative candidate in Newfoundland who did Harper Man.
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't on the ballot when October came.
Out you go.
Yeah. It's weird to think, you know, you probably have experience in this, like being in politics, you should certainly, in short order, develop a thick skin. And
yeah. I haven't figured out where to get it yet.
At least you're aware. Yeah. Steinbeck, mm-hmm. to get back to that, though, I mean, yeah, it's easy to see a lot of parallels between what he was writing in the 30s and what is happening right now. And Of Mice and Men, you know, you're talking about people, sense of desperation mm-hmm. and, you know, drifting and getting work where you can get it. And, you know, the only kind of goal is to, like, make it to the next day where it starts all over again. It's
right.
That taps into something happening now.
And the way he tapped into it is very inspiring to me because... And I've learned, as you know, being a politician,
mm-hmm.
I can make a speech about that stuff,
right.
and people will go, yawn. But if I write a song about it, or a play about it,
mm-hmm.
or I'd love to be able to write as like Steinbeck, he made it a compelling piece of literature,
right.
so that you were entertained, you were absorbed in it, so those messages were getting in a different way than... him pointing a finger at you directly and saying, right. here, like he, although, again, I'm recommending Grapes of Wrath to people, a fascinating structure to that book where he'll begin each chapter with kind of a big picture thing about this is what life is right now for
right.
people that are struggling. And then he'll dive back into the actual characters of the book
mm-hmm.
and we'll see that their story is advanced, and bringing any of those things down to a personal level, and I guess why he's successful is that it's personal and universal at the same time.
Right.
So that's why it still resonates today to read it. It was universal enough that we can identify with the issues that he's talking about, not just from a historical perspective.
Right.
But he did it by breathing life into these amazing characters, and they've become part of Americana too. Like Bruce Springsteen wrote "Ghost of Tom Joad," and
things that's right.
carry things along for it.
Yeah, still on the banned list though.
yeah, that's right.
Let's talk about the Guelph Public Library in particular.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a busy place, and
it's,
you know, we're recording on a day where the weather's not too great outside, but still, it's pretty hopping in here.
Yeah.
And from your point of view, you know, when we're talking about are libraries still relevant and talking about closing libraries or cutting funding, what mm-hmm. do you think our library system's doing right?
Oh, I think this particular building and our branches have made a transition that I think is very successful and very necessary. to becoming more just a community hub
mm-hmm.
than being a place that you go and get a book out to read.
Right.
And I'm not sure I've, like, Cambridge has a new branch called, is it the Idea Exchange that mm-hmm. they call it? Which is kind of a hipster name. I'm not sure that I would go that far.
It is kind of hipster evocative, yeah.
Yeah. But if we, obviously, there's just the very fact, because now I sit on the library board,
mm-hmm.
readership is up, membership is up, which sort of bucks a trend that
yeah.
we were, the print was supposed to be doomed, right?
My sister had a teacher when she was in grade 5, this must have been about 20 years ago, mm-hmm. who said, books will be gone in 5 years.
Right.
They'll all be on computer.
Yeah. So I think it's absolutely wonderful that we still want that print as a, it's symbolic.
Yeah.
It connects us to our past, and it looks like it's still going to be a viable part of our future. We want to hold that thing, just the tactile part, in our hands.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, we also want to acknowledge that you come to the library, that's not the only reason you can come. You can access the digital technology. You can get, and
to paint a picture, we're sitting amongst audiobooks.
Yes, that's right.
And TV series on DVD.
Yeah. So and I was fascinated to hear at the last board meeting that in the library itself, there was great excitement when they went big into the online and the digital books, and
mm-hmm.
They're being used less.
Really?
And print is being used more.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like it was a bit of a fad in some ways, but it's still a viable, and, you know, I don't know about you, I use maybe equally.
Right.
But so they've all found a place, and the place is, it's this building, which is why, you know, I'm a strong advocate for making this building more vibrant, for having, there's so many models now across Canada that enhancing main library branches can be of great economic benefit, cultural benefit,
right.
And I'm honored to be sitting in this vibrant place, but this building, it was built in 1960,
mm-hmm.
and it hasn't actually increased its square footage or the services it's been able to offer since then, and yet the population of Guelph must have quadrupled since then, I would think.
Yeah, when you put it that way.
Yeah. So it's become a hot political issue for some, and yet it's just such a no-brainer for me. I go, well, duh. This is our population.
Mm-hmm.
These are still important parts of our cultural identity. Let's keep up with it. It just seems like a no-brainer. And yeah, so it's, maybe it points to some of the same issues we're talking about banning books. It would be the same people that would want to ban a book that might say, well, maybe we don't need that kind of access anymore,
right,
in the internet age, where we can closet ourselves in our bedrooms and look at a blue screen instead. I don't know.
I always say the biggest lines I encounter at Christmas time are in the bookstore.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's always 20 people deep.
Yeah. The longer lines because we have fewer bookstores now, too.
Possibly.
Yeah.
But I think it's been the same for about 10 years.
Yeah.
And maybe there are more bookstores. Yeah. But yeah, it's invariably, that's where you always find the
it's
longest
a good
line.
Point.
Maybe to wrap up,
sure.
Bringing it back to Freedom to Read Week.
Mm-hmm.
If there's, as a reading advocate and someone who likes to read, what do you hope people might take away? Even if
from
this is the first
week.
Time they've heard of Freedom to Read.
I think maybe the first thing I would hope to take away is the awareness of the privilege that we have in our society,
mm-hmm.
that in most cases, those books that we see upstairs here in the library have been banned, but we've beat the ban.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we've made them available. So that's a privilege that we should not take for granted, and it's a privilege that we can exercise that privilege as often as possible, and that will keep those freedoms more alive, too.
Well, James, that's a great place to leave it at.
All right.
Thank you so much for joining me in the library.
Okay, thanks.
Once again, that was James Gordon, city councilor and library and reading enthusiast. Special thanks this week goes to Lisa Cunningham, the communications coordinator for the Guelph Public Library, for helping to set this up and for arranging for James and I to use the space in the main branch of the public library at 100 Norfolk Street downtown. For more information about GPL, you can go to their website, www.guelphpl.ca, and for more information about Freedom to Read Week, go to freedomtoread.ca. And that's all for this week of the Guelph Politicast. The theme music for Guelph Politicast is from the Crazy Pills and their song Break It Down, which you can find on the Free Music Archive. The host for Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to previous episodes, and while you're there, you can also listen to Open Sources Guelph. If you've missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com, or you can reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. There is also a Guelph Politico Facebook page if you like, and you can find that at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And of course, you can donate to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/GuelphPolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, please consider donating, and I thank everyone for their donations so far. For all the latest local political news, check out Guelph Politico anytime at guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. There will also be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast coming for you next week. And until then, see you next time.